This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Alberto Orenja. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you, Chris. It's an absolute pleasure to be here on the podcast.
Cool. We're here at Wine to Wine. I can just see the main stage in front of me. We're in one of their little booths there. But you work for Marchese Frescobaldi, which is sounds very Italian.
It does. It's one of the oldest winemaking families in Tuscany.
Oh, okay.
So it's an absolute privilege to be, part of their team and of their story, which stretches for 700 years.
Yeah. And you're based in
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong, yeah. Not China, but Hong Kong.
Yeah, well, you know, these days this is a controversial subject. So if you say it's not China, some people will be looking at you sideways.
Yeah.
so let's say it's part of Greater China.
Part of Greater China.
That's a very nice political way to get out of that.
Yeah. It's completely different to Taiwan. Yeah. I just love that one.
no comment, Chris.
Oh, here's me trying to be controversial just at the beginning.
I don't know if I will ever make it back to Hong Kong after this podcast.
Oh, no, you'll make it back, mate. It's just whether you ever leave again. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, so what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk a wee bit about China as a marketplace. You're about to do a presentation here at Wine to Wine about China and the market in China. Everybody looks at China as this massive open opportunity, but it's also a massive death planet, really, isn't it, for some people? You know, there's a lot of businesses who have spent a lot of money in China and they've got nothing to show for it. Some people have built quite successful businesses, and then politics mean that they've lost these quite successful businesses. It's quite a mercurial, complex sort of place to do business. And it's not quite the sort of yellow brick road that everybody thinks that it is or potentially could be. Before we get into that in a lot of detail, do you want to just give us sort of the 10,000 feet view on China from your point of view?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a million-dollar question. You know, I think, you know, an interesting way to describe China is the only constant thing in China is change. So the country and the marketplace is constantly evolving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that you get to experience if you do ever have a chance to travel into mainland China is how quick things can change. So simple examples. You know, you get into Shanghai, you go there for a holiday, 5-day trip, you get to, you know, see different restaurant places you like. Go back home, come back after a year, there's a pretty good chance that 50% of those places will be gone by then. And it's the same with wines. So wine importers, wholesalers, distributors, you know, people along the value chain, those who stay in business for a long time are not that many. And that's, I think, one of the key features of the market that you really have to factorize into your market entry equation. So it's a market that needs a lot of care and curation. And as you explain, you know, it's expensive. So everybody wants a piece of the market. And you have all the largest corporate giants fighting very hard. And all the medium, small-sized players wanted to, you know, take a small bite of the market. Which creates added competition and confusion to some degree. So it's a market where, you know, if you want to be present, if you want to make your brand visible, you know, this is an extremely expensive operation to undertake.
Is it expensive because just the size of the country, or is it expensive because it's just an expensive place to do business?
I will say probably the latter. So it's more of, you know, the amount of brands wanted to enter the market. And, you know, there's only so much space to some extent. So it's a crowded marketplace. And, you know, the players that you can engage with, you know, the PR companies who specialize or, you know, to some extent they have some experience into the wine and spirits field are limited. The wine media are not that many. So they are experiencing increased demand and increased interest, you know, from overseas brands wanting to come into their country. And obviously, you know, it's a simple supply and demand game, I will say.
Yep.
So this is, I believe, the reason why it's getting more expensive. And at the same time, China, not these days, you know, it's very different from China 15, 20 years ago when things were just, you know, starting to crack and develop and boom. So on average, you know, the cost of manpower has gone up, taxation has gone up. So it's really different aspects. But, you know, these days, you know, when you think about China, you really have to think about a market which is very developed. It's not really it's not the same China that we used to know 15, 20 years ago.
Okay, yeah, no, that's a good point. You know, I always used to laugh at sort of the Chinese. I remember something like there was more Chateau Mouton Rothschild in China than there was actually produced and things like that, you know. it used to be quite an interesting market from that point of view. But I suppose one of the things that a lot of people don't really appreciate, you touched on this actually earlier when we were just chatting, is that when people think about China, they think about Beijing, they think about Shanghai, they might think about Hong Kong, but there's these second, third tier cities, and there's just hundreds of cities with 10 million people in them and things like that. And how much penetration is there in wine? Has wine penetrated from the big cities all the way through to these second, third tier cities in the middle of China? Has it penetrated into the local communities, these smaller towns? You know, where is the penetration in wine? Is it nationwide, or is it still focused in the coastal areas?
It depends on the wine. So as a category, certainly there is a fairly good amount of penetration in second and third tier cities. But then we are talking about Chinese wine. And, you know, Chinese wine, it's basically two, three really big brands that dominate production, which is mostly bottling. There is some viticulture in China. Viticulture is usually not profitable for most growers in China. Okay. So it's very often this is table grapes. Yeah. Sometimes it's grapes that are turn into wine, but grapes that turn into wine are actually not quite as profitable as table grapes.
Oh, okay.
Funny enough, this is a reality of the market. And so very often the big Chinese brands will end up using a small proportion of their own production, and then they will blend in some juice coming from Southern America, Australia, or, you know, other sources.
Is it juice or wine? I thought it was
wines. Wines. So it's and this is what really has a deep penetration into second and third tier cities. And then you have some brands, but, you know, there's very few brands. There's basically one brand that really cracked the Chinese market, which is the Australian brand we all know about.
Penfolds.
And so that, if you take, you know, the average wine consumer in these small second, third tier cities, if there is one brand they know about, it will be Penfolds. And the second brand will be Lafay, which is their name for Lafitte. Okay. And which is, you know, Lafitte is obviously, you're not only talking about Lafitte Rothschild in China, but you're talking about the DBR group. So they've been quite successful in, you know, marketing and promoting their products across China. And that's it. So when you look at Chinese wines and then when you look at imported wines, you know, it's two different scenarios. So if you take, for instance, instead, you know, premium to super premium brands coming from Italy, France itself, New Zealand, you know, these are more limited to the first tier cities in China. So where there is more of an international crowd with more exposure to traveling overseas and more exposure to, you know, let's say Western consumption patterns.
First tier, it's all there, pretty much, I would have thought. Second tier, it's more of a niche brand, or not niche brands, but there's less brand awareness.
Certainly fewer brands,
What about in the countryside? Do people drink wine in the countryside?
Not really. If you're talking about real countryside, which, you know, it's once again, you know, we should really define this, but it may be even as close as 20 kilometers outside Shanghai. You end up in places that are, you know, literally in the middle of nowhere, and you will see no wine shops, you know, no context, you know, where to consume wine. And if these people see any wine at all, it will be maybe one bottle which they are gifted for Chinese New Year.
It had to be a red wine as well.
It had to be a red wine. Yeah, so it has to be a red wine.
It's lucky wine comes in two colors, at least white and red, because red must be the popular flavor.
Yeah, it is the popular flavor, and the estimates tells us that 80% of wines that is consumed in China is red, still red wine. Yeah. So that's still big in China and in Asia in general.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting because in the UK, a lot of people start off on white wines and then they'll move up to red wines because the tannins is an issue for some people. But in China, it's just red, red, red. Okay.
Yeah, it's the other way around in China. So there's a few factors. First of all, you know, red wine is associated to health properties, you know, white wines, you know, white is not a good color in China. In general, when you, it's actually a color that they use for mourning. And then, on average, Chinese, especially in these second, third tier cities, they don't really drink chilled drinks. So, if you're drinking a white wine in a restaurant, you know, off the coast of Zhejiang or in central China, it's going to be room temperature. And if it's in the summer, room temperature is pretty gruesome. Yeah. and the same goes for bubbles. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, same goes for it. Bubbles is it's a small market in China compared to what we know in Europe, you know, certainly in UK.
But what about these Italian red wines like Frascati? Frascati is sparkling red, isn't it?
Frascati, well, this is a really niche appellation for exports in general. It doesn't really make it to China much. I don't think it's actually one of the very few wines that I never recall seeing ever in China.
Okay. I just thought that might be something that might break the mold a little bit for them.
No, they thought a lot of people in the last 15 years thought that theorized that Lambrusco should be an ideal drink for the Chinese market because it's you know, it's got this nice off dryness or sweetness sometimes, some light bubbles, you know, kind of pétillance, great with, you know, the flavors of Chinese cuisine. But then you go to China and you see that they have absolutely zero awareness to what we call wine pairing. So there is no concept for, you know, food and wine pairing really. It's just something that we are trying to impose on their culture whenever we do wine education events and things. And it's accepted in, once again, you know, if you go to a nice fine dining Chinese restaurant in Shanghai or in Beijing, you know, they understand that concept and, you know, they go there for that experience. If you're in a local restaurant in the same city, forget about pairing. You know, you do beer with your meal, and then you crack a nice bottle of red after the meal is over.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's it.
Okay, that's cool. All right, we're here at Wine to Wine, and there's a lot of Italians here trying to do work out how to export to all parts of the world, and China being an interesting market for them. If you're an Italian exporter, where do you go about? Do you go out and you just go, okay, it's like if you go to UK, you find yourself a wholesaler who is in the market segmentation you're looking for, whether it be in the restaurant trade or whatever, and then you construct a relationship with your wholesaler, and hopefully that's job done, bit of support to them every now and then, and you're sort of selling millions of cases of wine. That's the dream. Is that the same sort of thing in China?
Not quite. So this is actually one of the problems, you know, with the Italian wine brands are experiencing, is that on average the Italian wine producers have very little knowledge about the Chinese market, the route to market that you have ahead of you in China and the value chain of the Chinese market. So if you don't do your due diligence, you know, ahead, it's actually, it can go very well. It can go awfully wrong. So I think, you know, the way you need to start things is you must find an importer. Because in order to import wines into mainland China, you need to have an import license and an alcohol license. So finding an importer is not the hardest task, I would say. So, you know, one of the analogies I always use in order to summarize the Chinese market is the image of a funnel. Yep. So imagine a funnel where, you know, at the top you have a very wide range of importers that are available and they're in business and, you know, open to take new wines.
Are they importers specifically designed for wine, or are they just importers? So they could import wine, they could import beer, they could import widgets.
It depends. They may be specializing in wines. They may be wines and spirits importers, less common. They may be food importers who have a wine division. Mm-hmm. And they may be corporate groups that are just importing, you know, active in totally different fields, that are just importing wines for their own internal consumption. You know, Chinese New Year's, gift giving, you know, gifts for suppliers, customers, very, very random. So it can be a variety of different players. But, you know, there's certainly no scarcity of that. When things get more complicated is when you're assessing the route to market that each single one of these players has, then, you know, the real route to market and the avenue for sales is, that's the narrow end of the funnel. So it gets really difficult to find an importer that has fast rotations, you know, stable depletions, and, you know, and therefore that can ensure and guarantee that your wines is always going to be in a nice, you know, perfect condition, latest vintages available. You know, that's a big issue because, you know, a lot of it, you know, very often many importers will just start by ordering off one, you know, container basis. So it's a lot of wine. It can be like 10,000 bottles, you know, or even more, just to build their pipeline and their own stock position. But then, you know, after 6 months or after a year, you know, you go, you visit, and you find out that the vast majority of your wine is still sitting in their warehouse, you know, because they've been having issues finding viable route to markets and therefore ways to sell the wine. So I believe that this is a key challenge currently for especially Italian wine producers looking for an avenue to distribute and sell their products into this marketplace.
So people buy in a container of wine without really having an idea.
Without having a plan. Let's say with a very random and very not really well thought plan sometimes.
Yeah.
So that's always a risk. Or, you know, it may also be what happened to me personally in my past experience. It may be successful importers that are doing well with Chilean wines, you know, with French wines, with Australian wines. But then when it comes to Italian wines or maybe some secondary regions in France, you know, they are not that strong. I mean, they have a hard time, first of all, building the brand, and then capitalizing on sales. So it's once again, you know, I think it really boils down to the amount of due diligence you can do before starting business with a partner in that country. Yeah.
I remember when I first got into the wine trade, and we were thinking about, you know, well, we wanted to start our own business, and we weren't quite sure what type of business we wanted or even what sector to go into. And I remember spending evenings, a year or so, every evening sitting with my wife, going through different business models, looking at different things, trying to understand what we could do or maybe what we wanted to do. And in the end, I had a moment of epiphany, drinking ice wine in Canada, going, I'm joining the wine trade. But then we were like, well, what do we do in the wine trade? And the first thing we thought was, well, we'll import New Zealand wine. So we started looking at that, and then we realized that importing wine was great. You know, you get to go out and buy the wine. The trouble was working out how to sell the stuff. And buying wine's great, but you don't last in business if you can't flog it.
And more often than not, the wines that you that are your favorite often won't really sell that much. So that's always what bothers wine salesmen, I guess. You know, it's the wines that you always favor sometimes are the ones that the market really doesn't is not really interested in.
So what are the classic routes to market in China?
So there's it's a very varied marketplace, but I will say to some degree in first-tier cities, so, you know, in the big cities such as Shanghai, Beijing, Shenzhen, Guangzhou, you have international restaurants, fine dining, you have hotels, obviously. So this is really not too dissimilar to our model in Italy rather than in UK. You know, you do need some on-premise specialists who are really looking after that channel, and usually they will have specialized on-premise teams that will go and call on accounts and visit them.
Yeah.
So that is one part of the market. Then you have off-premise, which is, you know, really a wide range of different channels. You go from the classic chains, big retailers in China, but, you know, retail, wine in retail is still relatively underdeveloped. And, you know, most supermarkets or hypermarkets in China will have a wine section. Their selection is usually not that great, but they will really focus more on whatever their local suppliers are able to offer and what sort of support they can get out of that. So
marketing support, like marketing, discounting?
And also stuffing, because, you know, once you get your wine as a supplier, as a local supplier in China, once you get your wine listed in a supermarket chain, then you're expected to provide service by putting your salespeople on the floor. So you must also have promoters,
yep,
which are spending weekends, days during festivities, you know, key festivities when wine consumption is quite high, standing there on the floor and pushing the wines that you want to push. So that is something really, really common in the market. And it's a big investment. And this is why you don't really have that many players in this channel. And then you have the wholesale market, which is, you know, a completely different animal. And in the wholesale, you have obviously wholesalers. So you can imagine something similar to the U.S. system, but it's not mandatory. I mean, in China, you could sell, as an importer, you could sell your wines direct to a consumer or to a wholesaler or to a restaurant, you know, without any restriction. But, you know, in order to overcome some logistic hurdles and also some financial hurdles, you know, payments and, you know, deliveries, many importers will prefer to go through wholesalers to serve, you know, especially the second, third tier cities where they can't really afford to have people on the ground. Mm-hmm. So the wholesalers become a key player. Yeah. And making sure that wholesalers have enough margin on whatever they're selling is a key challenge, which is very often endangered by the new retail, which is e-commerce. And e-commerce is such a key market in China. It's, I believe, if my memory serves, you know, if you take 2019, 2020 stats, China had already become the largest wine e-commerce market worldwide, which sounds awesome. But then at the end of the day, if you look at that channel, what really sells well, it's either brands that are already super well-known and everybody will just, you know, go sort of price hunting, or wines that are retailed at, let's say, below 100 RMB, that will be the equivalent of 12, 13 euros retail. And that's a very low price point for China. So it's only, e-commerce is only beneficial to specific segments of wine. And very often, let's say if you have a very successful wine which is doing well in the wholesale channel, you know, with classic distribution, ending up in you know, either liquor stores or restaurants, then you will be challenged by e-commerce, because e-commerce will normally tend to create disruptions in the pricing system, and this is something that Chinese wholesalers and retailers are very wary about. So even if it's just a matter of, you know, 12 bottles sold at a wrong price on a local website in a very small second tier city, you know, that will be very visible, and anybody in the country could purchase that, because there is no, absolutely zero restriction on logistics and sales to other regions, other provinces. E-commerce has actually become something that is quite disruptive for other, for value chain in different, other different channels. Yeah.
Okay. I think what we'll do is next week, I want to wrap it up there, but next week I think I want to explore that, the whole e-commerce business in a little bit more detail. I also want to touch on what has happened to Australian wines in China as well. Ooh. since last year, really. We'll have a bit of a chat about that. All right, Alberto.
Thank you, Chris.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, Chris.